You are listening to Food and Wine Talk, WDNA 88.9 FM. Sommelier Natalie McLean, author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over, is with us today.
Natalie McLean's enthusiasm for wine is contagious. The accredited sommelier from Ottawa, Canada, turned award-winning wine writer with four James Beard Journalism Award and five Bird Green Awards under her belt, is with us today to talk about her first book, Red, White, and Drunk All Over, A Wine-Soaked Journey from Grape to Glass.
Welcome, Natalie.
Hi, Simone and Carol. It's great to be with you today.
Red, White, and Drunk All Over, A Wine-Soaked Journey from Grape to Glass, is one of the most intelligent books on wine I have read. You've translated your love of good wine and your desire to learn about all aspects of wine into an easy-to-read, interesting book with an engaging prose. You've interviewed wine growers in Burgundy to upstart Zinfandel producers in Sonoma Valley, and you've come up with vivid descriptions of tastings that make the different wine regions of the world accessible and understandable to everyone. When did you find out that to understand and write about wine, you have to travel?
That's a great question, Carol. I think that part of what makes wine special is that it's a product of place. So it's not like grape juice made in a factory. Wine is affected by the soil, the climate, and all the influences of a specific place. So I think you have to go to that place in order to understand the wine. It's like if you were writing a biography of someone, you'd visit their childhood home and interview their relatives to find out their influences.
Well, and your job as a writer and as the writer of this wonderful book is really to bring all this to those who cannot travel. You've done the traveling for them.
I've tried. So if you want to be an armchair tourist with me, that's great.
So you really explore the wine of world beyond the bottle in your book.
I try to. I am fascinated with beyond the bottle, what goes on around the glass, because there are a lot of passionate, colorful, obsessed people. And I want to find out why they're so passionate about wine. It's their stories.
I think you're one of those people. Your book has been described by some as a year in Provence meets Kitchen Confidential and then goes sideways. How did you get started in this wine world?
Well, it took a sleep-deprived state for me to figure out that I wanted to write about wine. I was actually in high tech, and I was on maternity leave with my first son, and I decided I'd taken a sommelier course because I was always interested in wine and loved it, and I thought, why don't I do something while I'm off on maternity leave? So I pitched a local editor of a food magazine on wine on the internet. She said yes. Thank goodness, did not ask me for samples. And it went from there. I just thought to myself, this is what I want to do. It's a great industry. The research is fun. And I love to write.
But this is an industry that's very hard to break into.
Indeed, yes. There are a lot of people with very impressive credentials who've been writing about wine a long time. I feel I try to take the approach that I learn along with my readers so that when I tackle a subject, whether it's Burgundy or Champagne, that reader, I hope, is traveling along with me and we discover the secrets and the joys of that particular wine together.
For instance, you start your book with Burgundy and you know, what you write about the different wine growers, their different approaches to agriculture, to wine growing, to wine tasting even is amazing. So how did this happen? Was it hard to get interviews with all these people?
Surprisingly not. Maybe it's because now I have been writing about wine for about 7 or 8 years, and so I was granted access to places that are not open to the public, like Domaine Romani-Conti in Burgundy. And I think that I think that wine people in the industry are just very generous hosts wanting to share their passion. But in some cases, like DRC, they just don't have enough wine to give out samples to the public, and they just don't have the manpower. But they certainly were welcoming to me to help tell their story.
So what makes Burgundy so special?
I think it's this Pinot Noir craze we're all on, whether it comes from Burgundy or Oregon or California. The Sideways movie was part of that. There's something about Burgundy that just brings people back again and again to it. It's the sensual experience. There's something intellectual about it. And then there's just the pure hedonism of the wine.
A lot of wine books are either encyclopedias or how-to guides, but your book is tells stories, and as I told you before the show, it was a real page-turner, almost like reading a novel to find out what's going to happen next. How did you come to that style of writing?
Well, I think I've always loved to tell stories, even as a child. And I think that now that I'm writing about wine, I'm certainly very interested in wine itself. But I think fundamentally people want to read about other people who share a common passion. And so I thought that the most entertaining way to write about wine would be to tell stories. And that the wine learning, so to speak, is almost hidden in those stories. Mm-hmm. So that you finish the book, you've learned a lot, but you don't even realize it, perhaps.
Yeah, one of your interviewees, you know, describe the way wine people usually write about wines some sort of a hoax, you know, all the cherries and the flavors and the chocolate and the leather. But I think that when you describe the way you feel, you do use those terms. I mean, is there a kind of meta language for wine?
Yes, definitely. Wine has its own language, and some describe it as the fruit salad school of writing, and then there's other kind of crazy terms that different writers use. I've tried to pick fruit that people will relate to, so I keep it pretty simple, not too esoteric.
A plum instead of a gooseberry.
Exactly. So that people can find meaning in the descriptions, but my focus is a lot about the people who make the wine. That's what fascinates me, although I know people want to drink the stuff, not just read about it. So
yes, I was very impressed by the description that you made of the biodynamic agriculture in Burgundy, and the fact that after many experiments, the wine grown biodynamically tasted better.
It did. It comes from that respect for the earth and paying attention to the fundamentals, and not intervening too much, because I think there's a new movement. It's very exciting that the less intervention, the less manipulation wine has, the better expression it is of the earth and the place it comes from.
You also write about the scoring system. I thought that was fun. I mean, we have so many ways of scoring wine, by stars, by numbers. Do you see, is there any difference? And why don't we rate other foods, bananas?
Yeah, we need a banana critic, don't we? Yeah. There's a lot of debate over scores, and I've spoken to a number of critics, Jancis Robinson in Britain, Robert Parker, who's very famous for his scores here.
Right. I think he was the person who really started the whole 100 scoring system.
He was indeed. He's really well known for that. And I think that because we haven't had a traditional wine culture, either here in America or in Canada, we've turned to those scores as we turn to scores for movies or restaurants or other cultural artifacts. And it's helped people gain confidence to buy wines. At the same time, there's a lot of debate over whether you can trap a subjective experience in a number. You know, can it really make sense to say that one person's opinion has this scientifically accurate number attached to it? So the jury's out. I do rate wines because readers want me to. Mm. You know, not everybody wants to spend a lot of time thinking about their wine purchase. They just say, tell me what's good, and a number will tell you what's good.
Well, that's the instant gratification thing.
It is. It is indeed. Although I have pity because, you know, life's busy and people are out there shopping and they're facing a wall of 1,000 bottles, and it's so like, just help me out here. Is it a 90 or what is it according to your taste? Uh-huh. And if I like your taste, I'll follow you. So yeah. That's what I go with.
Well, and that is what it's all about, too. It's your taste, and your introduction to wine in general was with your boyfriend and about to be husband, and that makes all the difference. With whom you're sharing the wine, how you feel that day.
Yeah. Exactly. Wine is about context. I think our memories of wine are imbued with the place and the people. You know, I remember one wine because it was stormy outside, and yet the wine was deeply sensual. And I just think that the contrast of just weather and my husband being there made that wine more special than it would have been in a, I don't know, a cement room or something.
Well, to get to know the wine so in depth, did you have a hands-on participation in harvests, for instance, or in the fields, or
Yeah, I love to participate rather than just observe an interview. I do that too, but I think it's a far more engaging experience. Instead of telling you how wine is made, I went and worked the harvest with Randall Graham. With Randall Graham at Bonnie Dune Vineyards in California. So I'm out there picking grapes, ruining my manicure. The hot sun is beating down on the back of my neck, but I can tell you what it's like, that whole sensual experience of making wine.
So did you ever, for instance, were you ever involved in the the sugar level in the wine and see what they all do to measure the breaks and
indeed. I went back to the winery. It's a very sticky, chaotic scene during harvest. All the hoses are everywhere and they're measuring sugar levels, and we're looking at these frothing cauldrons that look like witch's brew of the wine fermenting. It's a wonderful scene that you really don't get to see unless you're there during harvest. And so again, instead of really talking about the dry science of winemaking, I thought it would be more fun to tell an adventure story of actually being there.
And if people want to learn more about wine, what would you suggest besides drinking?
Right, there's no substitute for pulling corks. I do have a website.
Or unscrewing bottles these days.
Good point. I do have a website. It's just my name, nataliemclean.com, and I've put lots of information about the book there, but I also have a free e-newsletter that I send out every 2 weeks. Got wine picks, matches for food, lots of links to other sites, lots of other information there.
One
moment, Simone, because I want to make sure everyone knows the website. It's Natalie McLean, MacLean.com. And it's such a great website. I was telling Natalie how much I enjoyed her wine pairing suggestions with food. I mean, I think I will go to it every time I entertain from now on.
So tell me, right off the top of my head, what do you drink with artichokes?
Oh, artichokes.
Yes.
Well, probably an herbal kind of wine. Maybe Sauvignon Blanc might go well. Those are tough choices, tough matches. I've included some of those, like eggs and vinegar and some of the tougher choices, as well as some fun choices, like what to drink with popcorn and pizza. Mm-hmm. Buttery Chardonnay for the first one there.
Well, I see. In your book, you dedicate quite some time to champagne.
Ah, yes. Absolutely. I was there in the fall last year, and it was just marvelous to be there with all the leaves turning different colors and the magic of champagne. There's something about champagne unlike any other wine. They've created this mythical brand, luxury brand. They've done a very good job, in fact. But I visited all of the chateaux that were actually run by young women at the turn of the century. Fascinating history attached there. It's well worth the visit for both the wine and the vast history that's there.
So what do you think of Pop?
Oh, Pop, the Pommery's little mini bottles.
Yeah.
They're lots of fun, and if they bring new drinkers to champagne, to wine, I'm all for them, because apparently young people hold them and they drink them with straws for the straight-up experience.
Now, you also dispel the myth in your book about magnums, the wine being stored in magnums, tasting better than smaller bottles. How would this affect the pop bottles? I don't think it. To me, it didn't taste quite as good.
The little pop bottles didn't taste quite as good. Well, I'm told that they put a little bit more sugar in those because they are geared at a younger market, and they're especially geared for early consumption. They know you're not aging the wine in those little pop bottles, so maybe it wasn't to your taste because it was probably a little sweeter, a little simpler than some of the magnums and regular bottles.
You know, your book is really very comprehensive, Natalie. It goes from the field, actually, to the table, to the stem glasses. Yeah. You've really covered it all. And I think that you're on a book tour, aren't you?
I am. I was in Atlanta, and then I'm going back through Canada, across Canada. And I'm hoping to see a lot of the wine lovers. I'm doing reading events and tastings. It's a lot of fun meeting the actual people who share your passion.
And if you want to learn more about wine glasses, the George Riedel glasses that are made just for drinking wine, and if, in fact, the wine tastes better, you've got to pick up Natalie's book. You also talk a lot about wine stores and the retail end of the business, which I found very interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of intimidation when people go to shop these days, because for most people, you can't tell if you like that wine. All you've got is the label. So do you like a castle in the middle distance or a fluffy squirrel is basically it.
Or you just look at the scores.
That's true. People do rely on those scores for that reason. So what I did is I worked in two wine stores, one in New York and one in San Francisco for a day. And I tried to help people, give them advice, but I also experienced the bafflement and the intimidation a lot of people feel when they are shopping for wine. So it really gave me a better understanding of what the whole buying process is like when you're faced with those wall of bottles.
Well, how do you keep up with all the wines? I mean, there's so many wine regions now. It's not just France, Italy, U.S. I mean, we've got South Africa and South America, and Australia, New Zealand.
Absolutely. There's so much to learn. That's part of the attraction that I'll never be done. But I do log on to the internet. I'm very much online because of my own website, but I also log into about 60 other wine columns online every day to stay in touch with what's going on, what are the new regions, and I get lots of emails from readers through my site.
Now, I must ask a person who has won the award for the best drink writer in the world by an Australian competition, what your pick is for the week, let's say.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I do love Pinot Noir, and I know you've had a guest recently who is here with his Pinot Noirs. They were lovely. The one that comes to mind for me is Framingham Pinot Noir from New Zealand. I am such a fan of Pinots from New Zealand, Oregon, and Burgundy. I'm just enamored of them right now.
Well, that sounds good to me. And thank you very much for being with us today, Natalie McLean, author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over.